So, I'll start with a prelude. So, when we discuss observations in cosmology, so usually we discuss the CMB, the large scale structure, and it is crucial there that we have perturbations of the metric of the quantities. Otherwise, right, the CMB is not just ellipse with a with a temperature of 2.73 Kelvin. But we have a very, very rich structure with fluctuations which are small, 10 to the minus 5. But that most of what we do regarding CMB physics today is with respect to these perturbations.
So you mean a sphere, not an ellipse?
You
mean a sphere?
And similarly for the smaller scale structure of the galaxy, so of course we're having perturbations, and that they are actually, these initial perturbations are the reasons for all the activity in the universe, for the Milky Way, the Oersted Nebula, which is the personal favorite of mine, and this is the Proxima Centauri, the star, except. So, but then when we go to lower redshifts and we discuss the supernova measurements, so suddenly we say, okay, we ignore perturbations or we neglect perturbations. And okay, there is a reason for that. And it's exactly, it's coming from the fact that, okay, we know that like in the CMB, the perturbation is roughly 10 to the minus 5. And therefore, when we have it's squared, so because of the stochastic nature, so it's 10 to the minus 10. So we're saying, okay, let's neglect the perturbation. And if you combine these measurements, okay, they are all maybe with some others, but actually, so CMB RSS and supernova is pretty good enough. We reached the conclusion that 73% of our critical energy density is not accounted for by non-matter, dark matter, or curvature. And this is a picture of supernova 1A from so this is a picture of supernova type 1A.
Okay, and this is a very interesting topic. It's good enough. It's interesting enough that Sal Perlmutter, Brian Schmidt, and Adam Riess won the Nobel Prize for measuring these supernova type 1A because it was inferred that the universe is accelerating today. The expansion is an accelerated expansion today. And therefore, in order to explain this accelerated expansion, we have to resort to one of these ideas. Either we have a cosmological constant or dark energy, meaning, let's say, some scalar field slowly rolling down the potential, or modify gravity, or consider some void model. Now, all of these solutions, while they may be valid, you still, if you want to seriously consider them, you still have to take into account perturbations. And again, check whether the averaging of these perturbations, even though naively they seem to be very small, we have to check that in a consistent way and see whether they have any effect on the cosmological parameter. So in this work, we will not take, we'll not assume voids, we'll not modify GR, we'll not add any scalar fields, and we won't have a cosmological constant, which is actually, in hindsight, we should have started with a cosmological constant as well, but this is for future work. We're going to repeat the analysis here, having a lambda CDM, not just CDM cosmology. But so what we are doing is taking the most basic things in cosmology. We're assuming an FLRW metric, the usual stochastic perturbations coming from inflation, a cold dark matter universe, and we do a proper averaging of these inhomogeneities or perturbations and see its effect on the DLZ relation. And until now, the conclusion, so again, we should repeat the calculation for lambda CDM, and there are some additional things that I'll refer to, but from the calculation that we did until now, we have very strong evidence to think that the concordance model is not as ironclad as it is. There is these perturbations and these averaging will induce significant changes in the estimated cosmological parameters. Okay, and it's not a 1% effect, it's maybe even as large as the 10% of the critical energy density. So this is a prelude to the talk. Now I'll just outline what I'm going to do in the rest of the talk. So I'll discuss a little bit averaging cosmology. This is a topic which has also a lot of theoretical interesting aspects, not necessarily phenomenological ones. Then I'll describe the formalism that we use to calculate these averages. And of course, and then the last thing I'll do is, you know, show the exact application of what we're doing and how does that affect the luminosity distance redshift relation. So a few words about averaging cosmology. So mainstream cosmology, we assume an FRRW metric, which is homogeneous and isotropic. And simply by saying that, it means we're implicitly averaging over a small scale structure. We're implicitly doing some averaging here. And this is something that we should understand. We furthermore, we usually model the energy momentum tensor as a fluid, as a perfect fluid, which is again some sort of averaging. And even when we do deal with perturbations, so which are responsible for the generation of structure, and even though these perturbations at some point become highly nonlinear, we still assume that they don't induce a back reaction on the background. So here we implicitly neglected the possibility of a back reaction. And so here I'll just mention, or you know, you can see in the slide, the various problems that, or open problems, or possibilities that averaging can have, whether they are phenomenological, like you know, modifying the cosmological parameters. Maybe they can explain the coincidence problem. Or also theoretical aspects, whether how to, the averaging, the issue of averaging comes, in fact, from GR being a nonlinear theory, the fact that the equations are nonlinear. And therefore, unlike electromagnetism, there is a big difference whether I assume some initial averaged background and then follow its evolution, or I assume some, you know, I try to solve the exact metric of the universe and follow its evolution. And here you can see that schematically here. And so, for instance, an interesting theoretical problem is how to do that to the actual Einstein field equations. Like, let's say the field equations are valid at the solar system scales, and then, you know, I'll smooth out to these small scales to, let's say, galaxy or universe scales, and then whether I'll still have the same GR equations or whether, you know, some effective additional terms will be induced. So this is a very topic which has still many open questions, both phenomenological and theoretical. Okay, so now I'll discuss the formalism that we're doing. So you know, if we want to interpret the data and discuss observations, so we have to, the averaging that we do has to be done on meaningful hypersurfaces, meaning hypersurfaces which relate to physical quantities like redshift or temperature, or, and we cannot just say, okay, I'm taking some constant time slice or similar things like that, because okay, time is the coordinate, I can reparameterize it. So we need to really pick a meaningful physical quantity to do this averaging. And this is this slices here, which I denoted as A. And moreover, we should understand that observations are made on our past light cone. So for instance, in fluid mechanics, people tend to do some volume average of nonlinearities. Here we can, or okay, we can do that, but then there is a big question of, and people like Bouchert did that, but then there is a serious question of how do you interpret the data in this way. So for this reason, we're considering averaging with respect to the past light cone, and not some arbitrary boxes of different sizes. There have been past attempts to do that. So what I'll have here, this A, this will be sort of a time-like scalar, like the redshift or temperature. This will define my hypersurfaces of averaging, and I'll have the light cone, which at this point I denote as the V. And this is what I'm going to do. So my V, Now I call it V, later it will be called W, but this describes our past light cone. And now the current light, past light cone is denoted by V naught. And A is the averaging surface. And then when I'm doing the averaging, I'm basically integrating or averaging over a two-sphere which is embedded in the, on the, in the light cone. So,
I guess I must have mentioned this before to you. The redshift, you should specify redshift of what? Because, of course, so the redshift depends on your source and your observer.
Yes.
So I guess you pick your observer, but you still haven't picked your source.
Yes.
Different sources would have different redshifts.
So, right, so the observer is at redshift zero. And then the source, so at each redshift, I have, you know, that's the redshift of the source. So,
no, but I mean, like, if you have a cluster of galaxies, our galaxies will make different.
Each direction you look, you have a different redshift of your source. And so you have to take sources that, you know, all the sources which you think are at redshift one, let's say. It's not a perfect sphere, right? It's a perturbed sphere, and this is the hypersurface that you average on.
I guess I'm just saying at a given point in space you can have different galaxies. Velocity.
Yes.
I guess you're saying look at redshifts that are high enough that those particular velocities are negligible relative to the Hubble.
Yeah. So yeah. So right, the supernova data is good when you know the redshift is big enough, so the peculiar velocities are negligible. These local motions are negligible, and this is what we also do. You'll see that you know mostly what I'm referring to is you know redshift high enough, so I can neglect that. The formalism. So basically, what we're doing is a geometric procedure where you know we have an exact solution of the. We're assuming light travels on geodesics, of course, and at this point, I'm just saying, okay, if I want to average a scalar on this two-sphere, this is what I do. I have your a gauge invariant and the coordinate. Transformation invariant formalism. So it's invariant both to reparametrizations at a certain point, where A prime goes to A and B goes to B prime, and also a general coordinate transformation. Now A, I'm not sure I said it before, but A is a time-like scalar, and V will be a null scalar. So at this point, I didn't assume anything on the energy momentum tensor or the metric. And this is a measure which is you can use that. It's practically helpful for any general space-time. Yes?
You were comparing initially this approach to the spatial aggregate.
Yeah.
Somehow they don't just differ in terms of whether they're based on observables or not. Like in one case you're averaging over a two-dimensional surface, in one case you're averaging over a three-dimensional surface.
Yes, in this specific application, yes. You can do a volume average on the light cone. It means that here you'll have a theta function, you know, Heaviside function instead of a delta. You can do that. I mean, and then it will modify this a bit. You can do that average.
You mean average over all redshifts above certain.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is this is not the main theme of the talk, but yes. Yeah, so in this paper, they discuss these different possibilities that you can do a three-dimensional averaging as well. So yeah, you're saying from a certain redshift until today.
Is the argument that you're saying that the physical thing you're observing was what should be specifying the average that you should be doing? I mean, why would you, I'm still not getting why is this average versus some other average? I would have expected that, well, some of them might be equivalent, you could show that it doesn't really matter what you do, but mm-hmm. on other cases it should just be like coming out of the question you're trying to answer.
Yes. Yeah. It is a question dependent thing. So if I want to average, calculate the DLZ relation, I have, you know, my hypersurfaces should be redshift. If I want to do something else like temperature with respect to the CMB, then it's a different hypersurface. And yes. And if it's some different.
I should be able to. You're doing over the whole pass. I should be able to meet with an average over smaller, not all my light cone, just some part of it.
But that's the redshift part, right? So it's just a cut through the light cone.
What? discussed beforehand.
So,
but there's delta A.
You say I'm averaging over the two sphere, not over the whole hypersurface, right?
But if I chose a smaller two sphere.
You mean in a different time, like an earlier?
No,
at the same apart. Okay, so for that you'll need to right. So you'll need here to introduce some additional Heaviside, function, right, which limits your angles. We didn't do that, and you have to see whether you can do it in a gauge invariant way.
But that doesn't be observable. You only observe things at the line constant things inside the line. Well, unnecessarily tree nodes.
Or is it, so were you interested in observations on the light cone, but certain patches of it, or inside the light cone?
I guess I want to wondering what's the physics that's targeting this averaging over other averaging procedure. But I mean,
so this I have a natural interpretation, right? I'm averaging over a constant redshift. I'm solving a non-perturbatively, ideally non-perturbatively geodesic equations, and therefore it's exactly DL as a function of Z. If I decide to average boxes, then okay, so you average, how do you compare that to the supernova data? Or to anything, since it's not a causal.
You're constructing the average over the entire sphere.
The entire two sphere, yeah.
As opposed to looking in specific directions and constructing a local average.
Yes, so right, so in every direction you look, so if you have a perturbed universe, so each direction, the redshift is not a perfect sphere, but you know this.
I guess, is it fair to say that if you're taking the metric as a given and you want to compare the average quantities in the given metric compared to the fiducial unperturbed metric, that's what's
yeah, that, so yeah, so since you, so this will induce a deviation from, yeah. So the correlations between the fact that DL now is a perturbed quantity and the metric is a perturbed quantity, this will induce the deviations, yeah.
And but is it true, if you had these two different plots of, if you have this figure where you go first smooth, then evolve, or then first of all, you want to know how those compare. In other words, whether the input of the non-linearized equations evolve the average quantity of an average solution away, how much they evolve away from the non-perturbed solution. But there you need to do some averaging on a surface with the right dimensionality discussed by the Cauchy data.
Yeah.
You need to do a that's why you need to do something like an averaging on a spatial surface. A
initial, okay. Yeah, you need some initial surface. But, okay, yeah, this is related to the next slide, which, again, this is with respect to the paper I cited before. So this averaging is not just a simple one-time average. You can have, you can study its dynamical, it has dynamical evolution. It's not what I'll discuss in this talk, but, yeah, so you see this average scalar, you have a time evolution, so to speak, of this average, and it's a generalization of what is called the Bouchert-Euler's commutation relations. Now, until now, everything was purely geometric. I didn't say anything about the stress energy tensor. It was just valid for arbitrary metrics. But now, if I want to actually, again, do a calculation, so I have to specify, okay, what is my matter? And for example, in future slides, you'll see that I'm using the gravitational potential all the time. So what is the gravitational potential of cold dark matter plus dark energy, et cetera. So here I do, so when I do the actual calculation, I do have to insert this knowledge about the energy momentum tensor. And so this formalism, again, is not, unlike the photon that we assume that traveled on geodesics, the observer doesn't have to be geodesic in general. In this specific talk, yeah, we will take a geodesic observer, a geodetic observer, and the gravitational potential of pure cold dark matter or dust. So another thing that will supposed to simplify the analysis, in practice, the preservation of difficulty is always true. So we're using a special coordinate system which we call the geodesic light cone metric. It's a sort of a spin-off of this metric which was introduced in Ideal Observational Cosmology by Ellis and collaborators. And the virtue of this metric is that now this measure becomes very simple. So it's just a two-sphere integration over the two-dimensional metric. So unlike if I don't choose this coordinate system, so the delta functions that you have seen before, the solutions of them become difficult. So in this coordinate system, the delta functions are trivial, and therefore the averaging is simple. And another thing that I have here is that what is called upsilon here, it's just the ratio between observer and source gives you the redshift. So again, for this application, it's a very useful coordinate system. So just so we'll understand a little bit what is this metric. So in the case of FLRW, this W coordinate is the light cone coordinate. It's R plus eta. Tau is the cosmic time. This is the scale factor and the two-dimensional metric of the two-sphere. Now, an interesting aspect of this is that, again, since I'm still in the realm of general space-times, is that tau can be identified exactly with the time coordinate of the synchronous gauge for an arbitrary space-time. And this is done by trying to, writing the coordinate transformation, and then you see that this is the equation, and it's a very simple equation. Okay, so this is all I have to say about the formalism. Now let's do the actual application, which is the average DL as a function of redshift. What we have here is we have what is called Etherington reciprocity law. And this, again, this very simple formula is valid for general space times, and where DS is also called the area distance or angular area distance. And this is the definition in general. For FRW, it's just A times R. And this is what we'll do. We'll do the average on constant redshift. And since we're discussing a perturbed FRW universe, so we'll have fluctuations in the scalar quantity, fluctuations in the measure of integration, and we'll have correlations between these two quantities. And this I'll call induced back reaction, and it's specific for this formalism. Additionally, you'll have other genuine second order contributions of the scalar that unfortunately I won't deal with them, even though they seem even bigger than this induced back reaction. I thought I wrote it. Where do you see omega hat?
Omega
naught is today. What I called V in previous slides here, now it's a coordinate omega.
Can you repeat what you do include and what you don't include?
It will be clear in previous slides. The main idea that I will be able to compute exactly is the fact that I have correlations between the measure of integration and the fluctuations of scalar. I'll show you more specifically in the slides that follow. Okay, so the difference between what we did and other people is that first, so other people usually just, perturbatively solve the geodesic equation, perturbatively consider small angles. This you can do, at least in principle, this is exact. The geodesic equations are exact, the hypersurface is exact. And so previous attempts that people have tried to do is that's what they did. They had to solve, for instance, perturbatively the geodesic equations. And so van der Velde et al. Considered the post-Newtonian case. Barousse, Cole, Pine considered super synchronous gauge super horizon fluctuations, claiming that it's a big effect. And then there was the rebuttal of Niaish and Razal and Hirata and Seljak saying that no, what these guys calculated is just a curvature, basically. In practice, of course, the computation is not that easy, and therefore we were limited to a first-order coordinate transformation. And this is somehow unfortunate because we need for a decisive answer, we need the full second-order treatment. So let's say I did the calculation to first order, and I can just say, okay, I have DL as a function of redshift. Now I'm speaking schematically, of course. However, what it means is that I'm using a specific realization. So this is sort of an equivalent of a void model. I'm picking one specific gravitational potential. And if I don't want to do that, then psi, the gravitational potential, is a stochastic property. And therefore, its statistical or ensemble average is zero, while its squared ensemble average will be non-zero. And then when I do the average of the scalars, so like I said, I'll have fluctuations in the integration measure, fluctuations in the scalar, and this I expand perturbatively. And then this is how I get, the deviation from the unperturbed case, I get these terms. So this is the correlation term that I was discussing, the fact that I have correlations between the measure of integration and the scalar. And this is a genuine second-order contribution of the scalar. So what we're able, because we have the coordinate transformation to first order, we're able to calculate this IBR2 exactly. Okay, and also the variance, so since now the whole thing is a statistical quantity and not a deterministic one, we're able to calculate the variance to leading order, and that also we have exact. What we don't have is the sigma 2. We do know, and this is important, that we expect that this first order square, this sigma 1, will be in sigma 2 as well. But we don't know the exact sigma 2, and we don't know the exact sign. For completeness, so this is what we're doing. We're mapping the Newtonian gauge, the Newtonian conformal gauge, to this GLC coordinate system. So this is the metric to first order of the Newtonian gauge, and this is the coordinate transformation. So again, tau is like time, perturbation of time, W, you get perturbation of the light cone, and also the angles are perturbed. So now when I'm trying to compare FRW to a perturbed FRW, I get deviations from one. And what is important, there are two important terms. One is what you can call a velocity term, which is this IR term, which you can view as a sort of a peculiar velocity term. Now, this is not the peculiar velocity that Niash was concerned about, that locally our galaxy pulls Andromeda or something. This is from the metric, okay? And then another is the second, and this quantity will dominate in low redshifts. Okay, the second quantity, which is important, is the lensing term. And this term will dominate at high redshifts. And high, I'm not meaning 1,000, I mean order 1. Now, it's important to note that when I'm calculating the correlation, so you'll have the velocity squared term in both the induced back reaction or the average and in the variance, while the lensing squared term in the meantime will appear only in the variance. And okay, you'll see why this is relevant. Yes. I cannot hear you.
I'm confused by this distinction you made. The peculiar velocity is due to distortions of the geodesic rather than peculiar velocities. What exactly do you mean by that? I mean, a peculiar
So for instance, you can say that we are moving with respect to the CMB frame. This is an additional peculiar velocity, but we didn't add the CMB frame and have. Right, we're just saying, okay, we're having the observer and the source. And the metric, dictates their geodesic that they move on.
So does that term include distortions, basically redshift distortions due to the metric?
Yes.
So what? Aren't those peculiar velocities? I guess I don't know what you mean by that they're not really peculiar velocities.
So okay, maybe it's semantics. What I'm saying is that I'm not you know, a specific system, you know, a specific supernova, a specific galaxy, you're saying, okay, it has an additional peculiar velocity because there is another galaxy nearby which is pulling that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm not, I don't have that resolution. I'm not adding a...
So I guess maybe this, what you want to say is coherent versus incoherent peculiar velocities. The coherent ones are due to larger scale of the structure, and incoherent ones are due to open structure.
Yeah.
So are you like putting in a power cutoff somewhere in your potential that you're not considering small scales or?
Truthfully, well, maybe not because of that reason, but yeah, you do have to induce some. You don't. Well, I don't know if you have to, but if you want to trust your calculation, yes, you do have a certain scale above which you don't. Yeah, you cut off.
And are you sure the distortions that you're neglecting are smaller than the distortions you're considering?
Otherwise, you couldn't trust the supernova, right? The only reason you trust the supernova data is because you know that at these redshifts that they're saying they're measuring, all these small these local motions are negligible. At smaller redshifts, you cannot trust the supernova. They're not saying you can trust them. And,
but didn't you say this term is the term that's going to dominate small redshifts? Is the peculiar velocity?
Yeah. So I'll show in the graphs exactly where. So. Okay, it depends what you call small. So at redshift of 10^-4, everything is decoupled from the Hubble flow. You cannot trust neither this calculation nor the supernova. At redshift 0.01. Between 0.01 and 0.05, then you can start trusting both this calculation and the data. Okay, this is what I want to say. Yes. So in the previous slide I've shown the perturbations of the scalar of this DL, and now, as I said, there is a perturbation to the measure, the measure of integration, and just for bookkeeping, so this is the perturbation of the measure. Okay, and then you have 14 integrals to calculate, which is terrible because they're on the light cone. The final thing is that, as I said, this induced back reaction, which contributes to the average DL, doesn't have the Lenzing square term, while the variance does have the Lenzing square term, or the dispersion, I'll also call dispersion. Okay, now you have to, insert the power spectrum of fluctuations. So we're again taking something rather conventional, which is the WMAP best fit value, and we're using some analytical approximation to the transfer function for cold dark matter. We're considering only sub-horizon fluctuations. We can, in principle, integrate all the way to k equals 0, not k larger than h naught. It's negligible. It doesn't matter. We don't have any, it's important to stress, we don't have any UV divergence. So even if assuming that this spectrum and transfer function is valid to all scales, even if I integrate to infinity, I still don't get any divergence. Everything is finite. In the previous slides, maybe you can, you cannot see, but you'll have to trust me that all terms that which are way, way inside the horizon, so they go like this L squared. So when we go to zero redshift, everything becomes zero again as well. Possibly. So I think not, but no, I think in our case not, but.
Because the transfer function comes
If the transfer function wasn't, it depends on the power of k you have. So.
You're saying you need k.
Okay, so the analysis. So why am I saying, okay, so this is crucial. So first of all, we have to understand that DL is a stochastic observable. It's no longer deterministic. And therefore, you have mean, dispersion, skewness, et cetera, et cetera. Now, as I said, at low redshifts, the autocorrelation of the velocity term will dominate. And at the higher redshift, the lensing term squared is the dominant thing. As I said, currently, it's only the dispersion and not the mean. Now, as Niyash explained, and this is basically this box, so at small k's, which are much smaller than the equality scale, the transfer function is order one. At scales much larger than the equality scale, the transfer function squares scales like log squared over k to the fourth. And therefore, if we want to have, and therefore the integrand, we can schematically write it down as A, the primordial amplitude, which is 10 to the minus 9. And that's why we had very good reasons to believe that perturbations are negligible, times the transfer function. But then the important thing is that all these terms, and specifically these two dominant terms, scale like k over h naught to the power p, where p is 2 in the case of the velocity, and p is 3 in the case of the lensing term. And here is where you get the whole effect. So obviously, from here, you see why super horizon fluctuations are negligible, because k is much smaller than h naught. Also, you see why, when you go to the UV, it's again negligible, because k to the fourth wins over k to the 2 or k to the 3. But at the intermediate scale, where the transfer function is not suppressing that hard, you have a huge phase space factor. So let's say k is 0.1 megaparsec, or even if you take k to be 1 inverse megaparsec. So you have here, when p is 3, you have here 10 to the 9. So this cancels exactly this a, the initial amplitude. And then you just have t squared. So this is the reason why you get a much bigger effect than this naively 10 to the minus 10. And okay, and here is the graph. So this is the velocity squared term with respect to, you know, unity, which is the unperturbed value. So you see that it's somewhat sensitive to the UV cutoff. So the thing here, maybe I should have expressed it clearly. The thing here is that the transfer function, until where you can trust the transfer function. So in the, you know, we have a lot of transfer functions in the literature, but they're always or almost always referred to the density contrast, not the gravitational potential. And here we need the transfer function for the gravitational potential. So in the linear regime, I can trust the transfer function because there is a clear one-to-one correspondence between, you know, delta and psi. But it's not so in the nonlinear regime. And that's why, so at the linear regime, we can trust this calculation exactly, and that's to this scale, and this is the contribution that you get. If you go into somewhat into the nonlinear regime, you see that you get an enhancement. This is bigger. And then you see that at some point, it doesn't matter so much. Whether you take KUV to K max to infinity or to 1 megaparsec, this is already negligible. But this intermediate range of scales between 0.1 and 1, it's crucial to understand what is exactly the power spectrum and transfer function there. So that was the velocity squared term. Now the lensing squared term. So again, you see that at higher redshifts, it goes up and it becomes dominant. So results. So the average itself, but at the level that we calculated, so it does give you a contribution which is much bigger than the naive expectation. However, it doesn't significantly affect the cosmological parameters. However, the dispersion is very large. It's so large that it's roughly 10% of the critical density, not of the cosmological constant, but of the critical density. Now, the reason why you mean this one, the fact that it's sigma 2? I think I cut it off from my slides, but so the thing is that DL over DL of, you know, FRW averaged both angular and ensemble average. So, you know, this is 1 plus this IBR2, that's the mean. okay? And this is something I calculated explicitly, or actually we calculated explicitly. And then there is this term that we didn't calculate, okay? Yes.
And then you're a score. When you calculate the variance, I'm just wondering, do you first average over directions and then calculate the variance, or then first calculate the variance and then average over directions?
Yeah, so actually we checked both of them in the paper. This variance is doing the ensemble average and then the angular average.
So physically, you see it's like one supernova and one redshift.
Yes.
So you don't average over all directions at the given redshift.
Yeah.
And then, so in that sense, then you probably have to do the variance first and then do the average
yes.
over the direction. But then, yeah.
What I would say the more physical case. I can, just a second now, if you want to. Yeah, so this variance corresponds to the following. So, okay, I'll write it as a general scalar. So this is angular all of this bar minus
first a square and then average over angles.
Yeah, average over angles and the
ensemble.
Okay. And yeah, actually it's interesting. So if you do the other way around, you get something which is small. You get, so instead of getting sigma 1 squared, which is big, you get sigma 1 squared, which is small.
So you're saying at a given temperature,
so we're not assuming a correlation
between same power spectrum, I guess. Well, in other words, there's this 10% the given redshift in.
Yeah.
My measurement of DL could fluctuate by 10%, and can I keep that down by taking measurements of various different values of redshift?
No, so I don't think you can. Because this is not because of the limited sample we have. It's not here in the formalism. I didn't, it's not like I said, okay, I have 100 supernovae and that's why I have the dispersion. The dispersion is inherently coming from the fact that at different directions, I see for a constant redshift different DL.
Right.
And then
different redshifts.
Yeah. No, but let's say at a constant redshift.
Right.
So in each direction, I'll see.
How many supernovae you measure at that redshift?
Yeah.
You'll still get off by 10%.
Yeah.
But
I don't think that's true. I think it's just if you measure one supernova at one redshift, you're off by 10%.
No, he's saying the actual average, if you actually sampled, if you had enough supernovae to measure every point on the sphere,
yeah,
computed their average, that their expectation value would be off from the uncontrolled value.
You cannot beat the dispersion because now it's
you can't beat the dispersion.
No,
the way you beat the dispersion is by having more data.
Yeah, but the data will still remain scattered because.
But that's how you can average them to get. There would be, of course, the scattering them, but if you can average them, you get
a small. No, but it's like, so okay, you can average the fluctuations in the CMB and get a 2.73 Kelvin temperature. But this you can do. But the CMB has more information. It has fluctuation.
And therefore,
the same thing. So now you'll have the DL, and okay, you'll have an average, which is closer to a certain extent to a mean or not, to the lambda CDM or not, but then you'll have a dispersion. And this will be non-zero.
Sure. So do we, maybe agree with each other then?
I don't think so.
Yeah. So I think it's saying that, so you're saying that 10% dispersion in supernova luminosity distance is like 10 to the minus 5 dispersion in CMB temperature. These are the same singular statements, right? I mean, these guys are talking about the same dispersion.
In the sense that it's the same, it's the statistical quantity. I'm not saying that, okay, maybe at the CMB you have one sphere that you average on, and therefore there the fluctuations are of a different, you know, temperature, and that's a different nature of dispersion.
So, so the point is that like every direction in CMB that you look at, I get 10 to the minus, plus 10 to the minus 5 or minus 10 to the minus 5 above or below the average.
Yes.
But if I average over, say, large patch, then I get a smaller fluctuation. And I think in the same sense, if I have a lot of supernova, individual ones will be 10% above or 10% below. But then if I average over a lot of them at the same redshift, I will get something as best as scattering.
You'll get the mean. This is
I
the
get the mean.
You'll get the mean. This is the calculation of the mean.
I guess I think what he's saying is that even if the exact CMB average around us is 2.73 Kelvin, that different observers at different points in the universe who look out and measure the CMB spectrum, CMB temperature around that, will see different values.
Yeah, so
at a fixed value of density.
I guess CMB may not be the best analogy, because CMB has larger scale fluctuation, but I mean this is what mainly small scale. So that
you're saying even if you have 10 trillion supernovae at redshift 1.
Yeah.
The average luminosity distance you get from that will still fluctuate, but it will still be 10% away from the curve.
Yeah, you should get a scatter. So if I skipped one slide, but just so let's say when this is my K max, so you see you have all this shaded region. And so assuming you'll measure many, many supernovas, so they in redshift 1, they'll be scattered. Okay, this is okay, let's consider point 1. They'll be scattered here. So of course you can average them and get the mean, but they'll be scattered. Okay? No matter how many you take. And so I don't know if which of ones agree with whom, but this is my the point here. That
yes, you're saying no matter how many supernovae you have.
Yeah.
When you take their mean.
No, when you take the mean, you'll get one number, which is the mean. But then when you'll calculate their dispersion, you'll have a dispersion. And this should be the dispersion. This.
I think
it's
saying that dispersion, if you have more, you still have a dispersion. But that
yes.
Okay, you're right.
Okay.
I think, Leighton, are you asking about a bias? That if, even if you average
you're saying
them, you get the wrong...
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Are you asking if there's a bias that even if you average them all, you'll get the wrong mean by a certain amount? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Yes.
I thought that each individual observer at a different point in an FRW universe, if they exactly measure the average luminosity distance at a given C, that what he's saying is that value will fluctuate from observer to observer in the universe.
Yes.
At like the CMB will.
Is that what you're saying?
The second time I actually thought you agreed with me on it. So then I'm not confused about who agreed with
it. I think there is a bias, and if you showed what the bias is, right?
You want to?
Yes. So what's the difference between the shaded region and then the other line?
The shaded region, this is lambda CBA with 0.73, that's the black one. The dashed blue line, which you barely see here, that's the mean, the average that we calculate, and the shaded region is the dispersion.
So how about the other line that's just off the...
So this is the 0.0, dotted line, that's the omega lambda equals 0.1.
So I think that's the bias, which I mean, if you want to call it.
IGR to represent.
This is the angularly average value DL over
yeah.
The after-curve value, not the distribution moment for DL of a given supernova, but but the angularly averaged.
Yeah, yeah, this is definitely the angularly averaged ensemble average mean of the end.
So if I take a billion supernovae distributed over the sphere at a fixed redshift,
yes,
and calculate their mean value,
yes,
it work a billion, billion, billion.
Yeah.
Then their average quantity will not be this 10 to the minus 4, 1 plus or minus 10 to the minus 4, right? It will be, because taking a billion, billion, billion supernovae is taking one sample of this distribution. Isn't that true? If this is the... Whereas if you took a billion different observers distributed throughout the universe and averaged each of their measurements, the average value of those would approach.
But then, what do you mean? How do you take a million observers so which of them would have a different redshift? I mean, I'm not. So, like any statistical quantity, when you take a billion realization,
I guess there are two different statistical quantities. One is that distribution, or you measure the luminosity distance to one supernova at a given redshift. What is this distribution?
The distribution function of one
of a single supernova. And there's a distribution function.
But then, so wait, but then this
over a sphere around the fixed observers. The question is, which of these is that?
I'm not understanding your distribution for a single supernova. So you have a single supernova, and you say its line of sight to you is a single realization. Is that what you're saying? This is the ensemble average. The fact that we have our universe is a single realization, so each supernova has some fluctuations along the line of sight. Because I'm not sure I understand your question. So my line of sight.
Take the CMB example.
Okay.
Even if the exact temperature around us is 2.7 degrees Kelvin.
Yeah.
But then you ask for different observers at different points in the universe at the moment when they measure the same level constant and so forth. Do they measure all the other same homogeneous parameters that we do?
Mm-hmm.
Do they measure the same exact average CMB temperature around that average one? That's different. That variance over different realizations, if you want, or over different positions located the observer is different than the variance around a single observer if you look at the pixel.
Okay.
So the question is which are we talking about here? So in the analogy of the supernovae, different observers at different points of space, but at a fixed value of the Hubble constant and so forth, will measure different. If they were both given 10 billion supernovae at redshift 1, they would have a different average luminosity distance at redshift 1. That's one sort of distribution. But then there's, for a single observer, he looks at this billion supernovae at redshift 1. What is their distribution?
Okay.
Which variance is this?
So we didn't consider a billion observers. Okay. I think we're considering our own past light cone, and therefore we're considering ourselves as measuring a billion supernovae. And then, okay, so obviously you'll have an average luminosity distance. And obviously, you know, since now you can construct correlations of that, so you have a dispersion in this luminosity distance. So again, my claim is that once we measure enough supernovae, you know, at this redshift, you should see a scatter here, no matter how many. Well, if you just, you know, plot it. Then if you say, okay, I'm bidding them, I'm averaging them, then of course you'll get a number. Not. This is my interpretation.
Adrian,
yes.
On this plot, do you show us, so the blue is how much scatter you actually see?
Blue is the dispersion, yeah.
Blue is the dispersion. do you actually show us the difference between what you would get if you averaged over all the dispersion versus what you'd get if you just assumed homogeneous FRW? Because isn't that the key thing you're trying to show, is that assuming it, I mean, so we get this dispersion, of course we're going to average over it to try to pound down the noise.
Okay.
But is that average value going to be offset from what we would have actually gotten if we ignored the perturbations, not entirely? Do the perturbations introduce a bias in the average? So if one of the
perturbations induce a deviation, you know, they introduce a net contribution to the average. We jumped ahead of it, but. I have to continue my talk to relate to that, but the perturbations induce a deviation from the usual FRW case.
Right.
Okay, you can say this fits omega lambda equals 0.7 or 0.1 or 0 or...
I
can
say,
you've
got
not...
a lot of curves on there. You haven't really told us what those curves are.
So if we're going to go back, may I just, go back to this slide and then maybe... At least it will answer Luis's question. So, you know, this is the 10 to the minus 4. The dispersion is large. And then the reason this is not the end of the story is because I know that this exact variance, this exact sigma 1 squared, which, okay, it should appear in this in the second order calculation. And therefore, I'm not saying that the dispersion is 10%. I'm saying that the average... unless there's fascinating cancellations, which also have to be explained, this sigma 2 or this sigma 1 squared will be much bigger, will be, again, this 10% compared to the 10 to the minus 4. And therefore, also, the average will be significantly different. Now, so let me explain this plot. So I don't know if I answered your... I hope I answered your question. This is the plot where the UV cutoff is at 0.1, and this is maybe a clearer plot where the UV cutoff is at 1 megaparsec. So again, let me explain the lines. The black line is lambda CDM with omega lambda equals 0.73. The dotted line is, again, a lambda CDM, no perturbations at all, with omega lambda equals 0.1. The 0.1, 10%. Okay, just a second. Then the calculation, the actual average that we do, this one, without sigma 2 we didn't, just 1 plus IBR2, it's this dashed line. Okay? And then the shaded region is the, you know, standard deviation, dispersion, variance, whatever you want to, you know, call that. So this is now, yeah, okay, so this is what we have. Yes, it's, again, this black line.
No, sorry. Just the CDM. Just the CDM.
Yeah, but you cannot see, right? So, yeah, it starts from here, and then you cannot see it because it's on top of the, and it's below the dashed line here.
So I guess I'm asking, if you just average over all your dispersion,
yeah,
will you conclude that you have any lambda? Or is the average over all your dispersion really
but what do you,
the homogeneous case you put in?
Okay, but what do you mean average over the all the dispersion? I mean, you want me to add this term to this term, but why?
I think you're just saying what is IBR2, which is small. I mean, 10 to the minus 2, you said. Is that 10 to the minus 4?
4.
10 to the minus 4. So that's, I think that's just the answer. The bias is 10 to the minus 4 after.
Okay. So the bias is very, very tiny.
I think in the interest of time, we should let maybe Peter finish.
Okay.
We can ask questions afterwards.
Okay. But it's an interesting question. to show, this is not the most recent data, this is from 2004, but because we plotted this with respect to an empty Milne universe, so this is data, you can see that also here there is a lot of scatter. in the meantime. And you can see in the papers that they don't discuss these ideas, but gray dust, extinction, you know, all these things that I know little about, but and they know much more than me. Summary. So basically, just to recapitulate what we did is we applied this averaging, this light cone averaging on the DLZ relation, and we analyzed in full this the contributions that's coming from correlations between the perturbations of the luminosity distance and the covariant integration measure. And we also derived to leading order the variance of the luminosity distance. And the last thing, which this is the promise to the future, but not in the moment, is that we know that this term of the variance, which is very big, should appear in the second order, full second order treatment. And it will dominate over what we already calculate, unless there are very impressive cancellations. The open issues in this is, the first thing which we're doing is, repeat the calculation for lambda CDM. It's technically a little bit more involved, but we're doing it. Again, for a decisive answer, because, you know, the sign of the sigma 2 and, you know, which way the contribution goes, it's unclear. So, you know, we need to calculate that. For instance, you see the problem of not going to full second order is the fact that, you know, actually what we're measuring is the flux. So maybe this is the quantity that we should average. And you see that here you have this contribution that was not here. And another thing which is still some sort of uncertainty is the fact that, okay, what happens in the beginning of the nonlinear regime, which you saw gives you a sizable contribution. I mean, the whole claim of this 10% that I was saying is based on, you know, this. The fact that you see that omega lambda equals 0.1 is all inside my dispersion. Okay, but this is when I start going a little bit into the nonlinear regime. And then there is many more work to be done. I mean, really, 5 other different projects that can right away you can think of. I would like to say that the main message here is that whatever is your favorite solution to the cosmological constant problem, I think I've made a good case or argument to the fact that perturbations do matter. And even in the very most standard case, you can have sizable deviations, or you have concerns about sizable deviations from the concordance model. And therefore, you know, take your quintessence model. Eventually, you have to say, okay, what happens to perturbations there? Are they negligible? Or they have significant effect? So, back reaction is here to stay. Thank you.
One of the criticisms of fast back reaction calculation can't be that, and lots of papers.
Yeah.
So the perturbation theory fails just when things get interesting.
Okay.
This was a something that's been somewhat unresolved. The other thing is that two other things. If you take a void cosmology model.
If you take?
A void.
Okay.
Then it's an exact solution of Einstein's equation.
Yeah.
And they're not so simple void model. It fits all the data available. There's no acceleration. Zero.
Okay.
So,
is the void a real void, or it has perturbations in it?
No perturbation.
Okay.
Everything's exact. So, the third thing is that the SPSS data. I recently analyzed this again. The SPSS data only goes to 0.3 redshift. So the results that you get from k less than 0.1, so it's very sparse. It's not going back far enough.
The results I get for k equals
0.1. The luminous red galaxies that are used to do the analysis to get the data. They're only back to less than 0.3 redshift. So you're not really probing we have in any of us.
Okay. Okay, so first comment. So whether the perturbation theory fails or not. So, okay, the extrapolation that we did is that we had to assume that, you know, we continue the power spectrum, which is well measured, one more order of magnitude, which we would like to know better. But at least, you know, in all the calculations that we did, we don't have any divergences. And in all the quantities, IBR2, sigma 1 squared, et cetera, they don't reach 1. They're smaller than 1, always. So, of course, there's more checks to be made, but, you know, we think our perturbative expansion works. And of course, if you do full second order, maybe you should do some estimate of fourth order and see what happens there. But in the meantime,
it's not clear as conversion.
Yeah, but it seems that it does work. We don't have the problem that Kolb and the other people have when they estimated for lambda CDF, for instance, also. But they said, wait, you have higher and higher orders that are order one. So in the meantime, we don't see that. The void model. So yeah, if your void model is an exact void with no perturbations, so obviously in the region inside the void, you'll have no back reaction. And then the question is whether how do you match the void to you know the rest of the observations. Third comment. So I'm not sure what I mean. We're calculating this roughly from redshift 10 to the minus 2, let's say, to redshift 2 or 3 or whatever. So if you want, so the SDSS has something to say about redshift up to 0.3. So
you were using matched power spectrum.
No, we were using the primordial. I mean, primordial times transfer function. We didn't use the galaxy power spectrum.
So, okay. This is an interesting result. So this is about perturbation theories. It's still interesting to you.
Yes.
Why does adding lambda make your analysis more difficult?
Because psi becomes time dependent, and it depends on right, and then if it's a quintessence, so maybe the time evolution is even different, and then you have 14 integrals, but at some point it was 26 integrals to calculate with time dependence. But okay, we're gonna do that. Yes.
For the close by supernovas, if you work in their redshift space. Instead of redshift space, you go to the real space.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for measuring the particular velocity of the host galaxy, if you measure the particular velocity of the host galaxy, then you can reduce this error about this uncertainty. And the problem that you had is that you are working in the redshift space as this uncertainty, at least for the particular velocity. For the distant supernovas, it's difficult to measure the velocity of the supernovas. For the close by, I think if the observer.
To what redshift are you?
I'm not sure about what size we can measure the velocity of the galaxy, but for the close by, if you measure observation.
Okay. So. Okay. When you go to these very low redshifts, then there is the question of which. Okay, I said at some point. I mean, I wrote it down. I didn't say. So actually, we were thinking. You know, what should we do? Maybe we should. There is the issue of H naught. What value do you take of H naught? Maybe you should just average H naught times dm, and then you get additional terms. Actually, but then you know we also looked a bit at the papers of the supernova people, and they're not like renormalizing H naught at z equals zero. They're fitting it at some finite redshift. And this is what we tried to do as well. It could be that at these very low redshifts, right? So, I mean, the thing I don't like about this, you know, is the fact that here suddenly I have a huge dispersion. But this is a theoretical calculation. Again, it's not because I just collected 50 supernova instead of a million. So it could, I mean, this, you know, in this very low redshift, maybe things can be reduced. As you say, if you know, if you have a better fit of H naught, or if you normalize H naught
no,
at some other
redshift. I'm not sure about the term value for the H naught. If you have a supernova, you have a host galaxy.
Okay.
So if you measure the particular velocity of the galaxy,
yes,
you can correct your redshift. So instead of correcting the luminosity distance, you are correcting on the redshift.
Okay.
The redshift axis.
Uh-huh.
So. Then I think this will resolve the uncertainties in the lower redshifts.
Okay.
So you're correcting on the redshift axis than the going to the.
Okay. But I think this is the very, I mean, our main claim is, you know, in this redshift, you know, beyond 0.03, let's say. And I think what you're saying is probably just related to this very low.
I think I was confusing things before by talking about different observers, different points of space, and constant
mm-hmm.
all constant.
Okay.
So I think you kind of said it better that there's two kinds of averaging. There's the angle averaging and the averaging over the ensemble.
Yeah.
And does this represent? I thought that what this represented was if I draw a random universe from the ensemble and compute the angular average of VL redshift 1, this gives me the distribution function of that average VL redshift 1. So different draws from the ensemble of universes,
mm-hmm.
I get different average value, angularly average values of VL.
Okay.
Is that what that is? Because that's different than the distribution function of if I choose a given line of sight. I pick a random line of sight and ask what is the distribution function of
the.
I mean, what wasn't that
the angular?
The angular everything, but that those two distribution functions are different. That the distribution function would be angularly average.
Yeah, the distribution. Okay. Yeah. So
the angularly average distribution DL as I draw different random universes from the ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
Is different than the distribution function if I say for a given.
Okay, let me say like this. If you look at angularly average DL and then you draw from different universes, yeah, this dispersion is smaller than the dispersion I demonstrated. So the dispersion I demonstrated is the fact that you look at different, you know, lines of sight and they're, you know, the photon is doing something a little bit different, and there is a scatter, and then you consider our single realization. So yeah, throwing the dice for different universes, this of already averaged, angularly averaged DL is a smaller variance.
Questions? Thank you.